today, Gadamer, on religion. And today we're actually talking about religion, what his view of religion is and what his view of spirituality is. And in some ways this is tying into the what is religion debate. Is there such a thing as religion? That many have weighed in on. J.Z. Smith's famous essay, Religion's Religious, I think it's called. Russell McCutcheon's rabble-rousing essays suggesting we should just get rid of religious studies, sort of suggesting that. Talal Assad, who's criticised it from different directions, not least a kind of a colonialist power-related one that I'll talk about. Tomokomo Susaza, Donald Lopez, etc., have kind of weighed in on this issue. So I'll talk a bit about how Gadamer, the hermeneutic character, how hermeneutics might want to try and define religion, and then a bit on what he sees as being, I think, linked to that, a notion of spirituality. And what we'll see partly is that for the idea of getting rid of the category is absolutely ridiculous, insofar as the category appears to have any significance. It need not be a watertight category, but it does seem to refer to particular discourses or concerns or forms of cultural development. Of course it's part of culture, but forms of culture, specific discourses in culture that have certain distinctive characteristics. And it's only when you try and use those characteristics to sort of ring fence and gatekeep a certain area of culture or knowledge that it becomes problematic. But that's a silly thing to do anyway. So just to start off, and I'm going to be jumping about in my text, so bear with me. So to start off talking about the religion debate. So one of the most thorough attacks on religion within the Academy of Study has been the attack on religious studies. And this has involved a move to dissolve the validity of religion and the religious as useful designations for culture or discourse or any other aspect of human life. The idea that religion's not a meaningful term has become a commonplace idea in certain approaches to religious studies. So you can see this in different people. Talal Assad has argued that the division of religion from other associated cultural spheres is a Western imposition that has been motivated by the happy accident that this, quote, the happy accident that this effort of defining religion converges with the liberal demand in our time that it be kept quite separate from politics, law, and science. So he links the development of religion to the notion that to the separation of church and state, effectively, and the desire to retain the religious as an autonomous sphere.
Mm-hmm. By religious studies, would that imply study of religion and comparative religion, or would you distinguish?
Okay, good question. And I think all of this is going to be their bundle theory, bundle concepts, because religious studies in the US can be its own thing, often study of particular religious traditions. It may also involve the theoretical study of the nature of the religious as a academic category. That isn't necessarily the same as the study of religion or nature of religion, which is an old subject which just tries to understand different aspects that are common to religion. So that is its own subject in a way. And within that, we've also got, the study of religion as this kind of more theoretical activity. So the theory activity, the study of actual religious traditions activity, and what's now become a kind of meta study of the nature of religiousness as an academic category is kind of what Smith is doing, are all combined in different ways and are given different names in different countries, I think. So history of religions in Italy, for instance. And I'm going to have to, because the countries do different things with that, I'm going to kind of flow generally through them. But when I say religious studies, we can also call it the study of religions in its widest sense. That is not just theology, and that includes a kind of a critical theoretical element to it.
And comparative.
Some of these groups would include comparative, some would not. So many would have the study of the different, for instance, Oxford at the moment, people are studying the different traditions, but they don't necessarily compare them. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's quite out of fashion at the moment. Mm-hmm. But some do. Yeah. Some do as well. So it's a mix. It's very fluid.
Quite out of fashion.
Okay. Sorry? Well, these things flow, but the Well, I mean, I think one virtue of the British religious studies establishment is that it doesn't make those lines too hardly drawn. So a person who does study religions may do also probably does religious studies in the sense of studying particular religion and may engage in comparative religion. And that, all of that's kind of open. So, yeah, and so others have spoken on this. Russell McCutcheon has also attacked the purported claim of religious studies to study a discrete sphere, arguing that what it calls religion can be dissolved into a synthesis of different cultural products, including text, practice, philosophy, and history. But these are objects that each have their own disciplinary field of study associated with them, and others, including people like Richard King, have highlighted the way in which a subject which simply combines other disciplines but is given a title for its own particular area largely because of political, historical, often colonial reasons, doesn't really deserve to be called a subject. All right, why not just say, you know, if I want to study, let's say, Zoroastrianism, why not just go study Avestan and then Persian and maybe Gujarati and then do history of those regions and then do intellectual history of those regions? And all of that together will, in fact, lead me to have effectively studied what we would have previously called Zoroastrianism. Now, while many have attacked the specificity of religion as a methodological discipline, this does not seem, in my view at least, this does not seem to be a concern that can strike deep into the roots of a field which has always seen itself as multidisciplinary anyway. So religious studies has always acknowledged that it combines a number of disciplines into the study of particular cultural groups. Groups not only of people, but groups of texts, groups of practices, groups of beliefs. From its very earliest origins in historical, textual, philosophical study of church and Bible. So Johannes Achuber gave a talk last night, was reminding us that the study of theology in Europe has always been multidisciplinary and largely to do with textual study and intellectual history. Or for that matter, if you look at the Islamic study, which involves extensive reflection on hadith and the relationship of historicity to the texts and principles which we find in the Quran, as well as the application of rational kalam theology. So you're always getting this mixture of historical context, textual exegesis, and rational interpretation mixed into almost all of the traditional studies of religion that might have been called theological. And arguably, it'd be interesting to think how that's true or not true for Asian cultures in India, for instance. So you always get textual exegesis, you always get, very often get rational application. The textual exegesis goes in so many different directions in the Indian context. Maybe less of the historical contextualization happens within the tradition, perhaps. But certainly there are disciplines used that are not, that are, one would validly see as being continuous with other non-religious studies disciplines, even within the traditional theological activity of many cultures. So religion has always harnessed diverse methods to the study of its own multiform, complex subject. In many ways, it would agree with McCutcheon and merely disagree that it's useless to notice the way that they link into study of particular religious cultures. Assad's critique is a more incisive one in some ways, asking whether religion as worldview, the account proposed by Clifford Geertz, is valid. And if not, whether the notion of religion as a symbolic level of cultural text can in fact survive. So Assad's critique is more focused not on the way it merely can be dissolved into other disciplines, but on the idea that religion is speaking to in kind of an ideology or worldview. In some ways, it's more focused on this notion of the religious as, to some extent, religious as intellectual phenomenon. The text of culture is, after all, always being rethought through cultural realities that are themselves much more material, much more realistic, in a sense, and based on power. So Assad has a kind of Foucauldian angle. The Foucauldian category that Assad introduces is accounting for the prescriptive power of these symbols. Assad is essentially critical of Geertz's structuralist interest in describing the symbols as autonomously persuasive, simply because they provide a worldview. He feels rather that they're persuasive because they shore up the real-world power structures of society that lie behind them. So Assad's critique of religion ends up being a critique between the ideas, a sort of a conflict between the ideas and the power structures. And in many ways, his critique has provided a flag-bearer for those who feel that religion needs to be analysed in terms of a kind of post-Marxist or neo-Marxist idea of culture as the result of political forces rather than as the result of autonomous, independent intellectual activity. And in many ways, Assad's criticism is interesting because it echoes Habermas' critique of Gadamer. Habermas, coming from the sort of critical theory schools of Germany in that time, was very concerned that Gadamer had not sufficiently explored the socio-political forces that give weight to worldviews through physical and economic coercion, right? So power is not being voiced. Assad makes his own assumptions about practice as an autonomous and more basic level of human activity than culture. He sees theology as being overlaid onto the level of practice. He suggests that one can act without there being any underlying implicit belief about world, self, or value. He writes, "Thoughtful Christians will concede that although theology has an essential function, theological discourse does not necessarily induce any religious dispositions, and that conversely, having religious dispositions does not necessarily depend on a clear-cut conception of the cosmic framework on the part of the religious actor." So Geertz's basic idea in the famous essay, Religion as a Cultural System, argues that one of the definitions of religion is that it expresses a worldview, expressing a particular order of reality, and that induces certain moods and motivations, particularly powerful moods and motivations that have a factual character to them. And Assad is fundamentally criticizing this and arguing that worldviews do not necessarily underpin dispositions at all. So one may have a desire to do something, but there's no particular belief system behind it, which I think is probably a very controversial view, actually. And one interesting context in Indian studies in which this became relevant was with regard to Fritz Stahl, who sought, I think, channeling many different, coming partly from anthropology, channeling many different current concerns in the study of Indian, study of religion generally. Stahl's book, Rules Without Meaning, as an interpretation of Vedic ritual, was kind of speaking on the side of the idea that one may do certain practices but have no particular cosmological order or worldview behind them, that in fact those two things can be completely divorced, so that you're simply carrying on those things, enacting dispositions which your culture has cultivated in you. So in some ways this is a debate that goes to the heart of whether or not rationality is necessarily involved in notions of motivation, practice, and lived religion. So, in many ways, Assad's view goes against the view of symbols that Gadamer inhabits. And with him, Geertz as a cultural theorist. Worldview for him is never, for Gadamer and for Geertz, worldview is never merely propositional, merely intellectual, merely descriptive, but always entails values as well as facts. It is precisely the distinction that Gadamer seeks to undercut in his opening critique of Kant at the beginning of Truth and Method. So he notices that Kant sets up a model of an idea, if you like, a fact assertion that is separate from personal feelings, motivations, ethos and taste that is behind it. So ethics and fact become divided in Kant. That's one of the first observations he makes in Truth and Method, and he says that's fundamentally problematic. So I think from this perspective, the structuralist and also the hermeneutic perspective, the enactment of power, coercion of a person, always is already grounded in some worldview which causes that person to want to enact power, right? So you can't reduce any human activity merely to some kind of pre-established biological disposition, for instance. There's always a value-creating view underlying it. In some ways, much more linked to Charles Taylor, I think. So we don't get to separate cultural view and practical practice. So they're on that side of the line. Now, in many ways then, Gadamer emerges as the defender of the idea that worldviews still are the basis of society, that they still have fundamental determining power, actually, over ethics, that there isn't a prior, for instance, bio text that humans are basically voicing and onto which culture is overlaid. So he's very much against the Darwinian materialist approach. The great challenge is for him to be able to define what it is that is a specifically religious kind of worldview. Okay, so Geert says religions are worldviews, symbols expressing worldviews, expressing this idea of order with particularly powerful influences that seem factual. And it's been noted that that can apply to almost any culture. It needn't be religious as such. We're talking about the importance of ideas of what the self is. That's not automatically a religious issue. It's a universal philosophical issue, indeed a cosmological or metaphysical issue, but not necessarily religious, arguably. So the challenge then is to try and see what it is that might define the religiosity of a worldview specifically. And that's what I want to look into here. All right, so what might that be? Go ahead.
Just possible to ask to the notion of worldview a bit more on that. Is it something static? Is it something that is coherent or just with cohesion? Is it something that covers sort of theology, sociology, anthropology, cosmology? And does it also, is it only the sort of the view of the world, or also the, if you like, the action dimension?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the action dimension is described, then it would still be described in a normative way as a model for the world. So as just to understand, is it all thought of as normative,
yeah,
model for the world, and is it?
It's a good question. I've introduced Gadamer here.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know that essay by Gadamer. Gadamer. Start again. I've introduced Geertz here, and I don't know if you know that essay by Geertz, Religion as a Cultural System, yeah. And he has that that five-part definition that he gives. And he does just sort of throw in the word worldview.
Yeah, that's okay for that.
Yeah, for that essay. And though he goes into it elsewhere, and it seems kind of linked to his idea of thick description. So I think for him, worldview is both a picture of how the world is. It's the descriptive dimension.
Yeah.
And that, I think, one doesn't say it's only cosmological or only social. It usually is a whole picture of how the world is, although some aspects may be implicit and some may be explicit. So it would be wrong to see a worldview as a carefully worked out philosophical thing, because most people don't have that in their head. But his argument would be that the symbol of the cross immediately puts people into a certain frame of mind where they do have a certain picture of how to interpret the things around them, implicit or explicit, philosophical or not, that descriptive level is there. And he includes with that, he often says worldview and ethos are combined, you can't separate them. And an ethos includes dispositions. That's where the dispositions and motivations comes in. Then it's normative as well, it's prescriptive as well as descriptive. Because, a la Charles Taylor, every picture of the world includes a picture of what is right and wrong, or what is good and bad, what is valuable and not valuable, and what the human person, what kind of thing the human person is, and how it's supposed to behave, or how it best behaves. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So, amongst other things, it means that you always have a normative or prescriptive dimension in a worldview, regardless of whether there's a God in it who tells you what to do. Right, all worldviews, including secular scientific materialism, become prescriptive in that sense. Hmm. Yeah.
And as a system, not just as a cultural reservoir of.
How do you mean by system?
Yeah, it's something that has the coherence, sort of like if you would speak about a theology and a cosmology and so on.
I think he'd argue that cultures that have no theological tradition, have no tradition of working out their descriptively the cosmology or any kind of coherent systematic development of it in writing, still have a worldview.
Yeah.
So it may be wholly implicit.
Classifications and so on,
So in that sense, it doesn't have to be systematic. But I think he'd probably argue that there is a certain coherence implicit within every worldview. If you read Islam Observed, it's an interesting book, partly because what he's doing that is saying look at what happens when a worldview changes and comes into conflict with a different worldview. So he looks at Indonesia moving into modernity, and he looks at Morocco moving into modernity and seeing the kind of problems that are created when worldviews clash, change, or problems within them that hadn't been seen before or discovered, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they may have problems or clashes. Were you going to...
I think you kind of touched on what I was thinking about. The notion that it's not necessarily a coherent, worked-out system, that it can be very much implicit,
yeah.
That you're always inhabiting some kind of understanding, you know, some mm-hmm. positionality and the way in which we value things.
Exactly.
But when you said rationality,
mm-hmm.
I didn't quite follow.
I can't remember in which context I said that. Sorry, probably it was very silly.
Something between. I think Talal Asad's critique, and this mm-hmm. says something about, oh, this issue is, it deals with rationality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure it's rational. I mean, like, I think that, I don't know where you're going with it or whatever, but it seems loaded, you know, that's like a loaded term that might not...
I think what I was probably trying to say there was that I think that Asad is creating a false division mm-hmm. in which he sees worldview as rational, and then practice... and normativity that everyday people do implicitly as not worldview, right? That's the reality. So he's actually limiting Geertz's notion of what a worldview is to a kind of precisely this systematic rational theology.
Right.
And that's when he says something like, he talks about theology has a function, theological discourse does not necessarily induce religious dispositions. I'm not sure that that's true. And having religious dispositions doesn't depend on a clear-cut conception of the cosmic framework. And if he's interpreting a worldview as a clear-cut conception of the cosmic framework, that's a wrong interpretation of Geertz, and exactly
it's
the way you're saying.
It's too scholastic. I mean,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
too much cosmology in a very
exactly.
literal sense.
Exactly.
Worked out cosmology.
It's some of your worldviews is a very fixed thing.
Yeah.
A bit like crystallization of a tradition,
yeah.
particular moments in time.
Yeah.
But if you speak in a long theory, you could use imaginaire or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think imaginaire is something that needs to be kind of unpacked as well, but that's
yeah.
right, that there's something a bit broader. So I think when Geertz, of course, does want to be able to talk about very implicit worldviews, and he's an anthropologist who wants to be able to write about Indonesians whose worldview is actually... can't be reduced to Islam or to Hinduism in Bali or to animist views. He talks about, remember the famous cockfight essay, and he says, why are these guys putting all their money into this cockfight to the extent that it's ruining their lives? He says, because implicitly there's something about this game which ties into a very, very important worldview that defines their self, their views of value, views of reality, views of manhood, views of how society works, etc. They wouldn't even realize themselves that they have this worldview, but it is in fact something, an idea of how things are that's implicitly shaping this. So for Geertz, it's definitely not systematic, explicitly rational, or any of those things. So I think, yeah, it's Talal Asad kind of misreading. Yeah. Well, so then we're left with this question about what is, in fact, what is a useful way to define the religious? And I've got a whole section that I won't read through on Gadamer's own background, but just to summarize, I think it's important to remember that people like Asad and McCutcheon and many others, indeed many of the phenomenologists, are writing from a personal cultural background of a certain kind of conflict, perceived conflict between the religious and the non-religious, and either they're trying to defend the non-religious or they're trying to, in some sense, revive and defend the religious, right? So Levinas, Ricoeur, Heidegger, so many of those figures are, in fact, in one way or another, themselves actually religious, and that's a major motivating factor in what they're doing. Gadamer's interesting, he's an interesting person from which to come at this, because his own experience was as a humanist, agnostic, spiritually inclined semi-pantheist, or at least this is how you can interpret him. So he's neither religious nor non-religious. He does not identify with any group, nor does he reject any group. And actually, he describes his early life as shaped by the cosmopolitan world of urban East Germany, where he was surrounded by Jews, he was surrounded by people interested in great German interest in classical culture as a kind of naturist, spiritist, pantheist background. He inherits the Germany that is interested in Indian and Asian literatures through Schopenhauer, through Nietzsche, through Hermann Hesse, who everyone was reading in his youth. He himself, as part of studying classics, did a bit of Sanskrit, and was surrounded. He remembers when Rabindranath Tagore came and spoke to his university gathering, and everybody was very sympathetic to this kind of thing. His mother was a German pietist, which means that she died when he was very young, but what she left him was lots of books of kind of personal, spiritual, semi-mystical writings about going into the self, inward reflection, contemplative traditions, working on yourself to become a good person. And these were books that had very little to say about doctrine and very little to say about those who were wrong. So it wasn't fighting anyone. It was just a personal journey. His father, on the other hand, was effectively a secular atheist. He was a scientist. He was a very successful chemist, who wanted Gadamer himself to become a scientist. Gadamer once said that he, like his father, just found it very difficult to believe in something like life after death. The supernatural beliefs entailed in Christian doctrine were just not really there for him. But he didn't deny them. He just said, I don't find them particularly persuasive or powerful in my life. But he also asserted that his father didn't see science as conflicting with religion. Right, so he's not in a world where that seems problematic. And in his work, including Truth and Method, he cites lots of figures who are on the pantheist side of German idealism. I'll talk about this next week, actually, is how he defines God. So a whole pantheist idealist tradition, vitalist as well, a huge German resource for redefining God, which has kind of disappeared from Anglo-American discourses about this. Either it's God or it's not God. Whereas he's in a world where it's very, very different. And again, the world that was much more sympathetic towards Asian ways of seeing things. And in fact, for him, so there's no big conflict, but in fact, there's a huge spiritual text in his life. So without having to be religious, everybody was concerned with spirituality. And the two particular arenas in which he engaged this were in the arenas of, on the one hand, philosophy. So his interest in philosophy in the 20s, in the 30s, was much inspired by the idea that phenomenology particularly was seen as a reinvigoration, re-inspiration of a new generation concerned to re-engage with the things themselves and to bring vitality and life to the practice of human reflection on the world. Right? It's a very idealistic and inspiration-seeking explicit discourse around the early years of phenomenology, which we now see is very, very dry. So this is very important. And in his book Philosophical Apprenticeships, where he kind of reflects on different figures in his life, he writes about how Husserl's lectures were packed, Heidegger's lectures were packed, and people went to them as a source of excitement and inspiration that the world was being made new. That Max Scheler, who we now completely forget about, one of the early phenomenologists, who was also a Catholic and wanted to write on the notion of love, on the notion of renewal of the self, much more, was a phenomenologist who really represented phenomenology as a form of renewing the self. And indeed, Pope John Paul II, I think, did his PhD on Max Scheler. Again, a forgotten character, but an interesting connection. The other arena, so philosophy was very important, and indeed he writes that his reading of Plato was hugely important. For them, as Pierre Hadot has more recently pointed out, reading about Plato, Socrates, and even Aristotle in the pre-Socratics was reading about people who were within a religious worldview. Right, at that time, German contextualization of early classical philosophy was a reminder that these were religious figures and these men were considered sages, and that the Phaedo tells the story of a man who is dying and talking about the soul precisely for the purpose of encouraging people to strengthen the soul. Right? So that spiritual practice and spiritual identity and spiritual community were central to even the very text that he was reading as a classicist and as a philosopher. The other arena in which he's getting his notion of the religious or the spiritual is in his poetry reading. And this doesn't emerge in Gadamer's writings until later in his life, when he started to write much more extensively commentaries on poems, particularly Rilke and Paul Celan. But others as well, and he mentions at various points the different poets throughout German 20th century history, but particularly, again, 20s, 30s, 40s, who were incredibly important in galvanizing young people throughout that culture to spiritual concerns. So it's a time which has an intense, constant spiritual discourse that, you know, one doesn't necessarily see in quite the same way now. He wrote at length about Stefan George. And he writes when he first read Stefan George, who at the time was a semi-mystical poet. People read his poems, and he was alive at the time, Stefan George, and people treated him as a kind of a sage, a guru, almost Zarathustra-like character, who was writing and speaking to the people. And that ethos, that aura that surrounded him, was only increased when the Nazis tried to appropriate him as a National Socialist sympathizer, and George declined their invitation and quietly left the country. And this was before, really, things had gotten going. He was an early figure of a kind of protest and the autonomy of poetry, actually. And Gadamer wrote of George's poetry, I'll never forget. So the publisher's introduction to this collection of German, contemporary German poetry at the time, went on to quote two of Stefan George's poems. I will never forget either of them. It was as if I had been struck by lightning and did not know what happened to me. And one of them goes, sparkle and glory. I'm sure this sounds better in the original German. Sparkle and glory. Thus awakens our world. Like heroes, we conquer mountains and continents. Young and great, the spirit looks, without steward, at the fields and flow that surround it. And you can see how that could be, you can see how National Socialists could want to appropriate it. Heroes conquering mountains and continents. Great. Right, but you also have this other side, that it's the philosopher. The philosopher is awakened. Young and great, the spirit looks without steward. So unrestricted, the spirit can now look at the fields and flow that surround it. And that seeing of the world itself is a kind of conquering. But a non-appropriative, non-violent, non-aggressive form. Right? He wrote at length about these various characters. He said, these poets showed... express that for us all that the experience of the divine is unavoidable, he wrote. Even when God denies and refrains, still the experience of the divine is something we seek. He spoke unabashedly of universal desires of the soul, the inner desire of the human soul, we quote, the inner desire of the human soul for a meaningful interrelatedness of the whole, which should also ground the meaning of one's own life and desires in agreement with nature. That's a really important line, and I could give lots and lots and lots more quotes that kind of go along with that. But this notion of an inner desire of the human soul that is innate, for a meaningful interrelatedness of the whole, so we don't get to stay in isolation. In fact, philosophy is what we're attracted to and is so universal throughout human cultures, precisely because we cannot live without having some notion of the whole. You know, it's almost saying, reminding us that worldview, as a formulation of the world around us, is the first step to any kind of ethics, any kind of action, any kind of practice or disposition in the first place. And that this also grounds the meaning of one's own life and desires in agreement with nature. You know, it's very much this kind of, in some ways, quite old-fashioned German idea that nature is always going to be the touchstone for rethinking what we are ourselves. And this means a need to, quote, acknowledge what inner value is, and what living in poetry means, and also for the devout, what living in prayer means, so that we can finally achieve, quote, an experience of the whole and ourselves in the whole, in a way that is not provided, he says elsewhere, by the language of science. Now, that notion of the whole, in short, I think is central to how he himself ends up defining the nature of spirituality. And I'll summarize this in a kind of a schema that I think helps to fill out the form of spiritual activity that he sees as basic to human life and expressed in distinctive kinds of discourses, of which religion is one. A, he writes about the existential. So there are for him certain fundamental questions of human life that cannot be avoided, that are universally of concern to all humans. And that, for him, is something from which we cannot escape. So in some sense, Gadamer continues as an existentialist. Right? What are those existential questions? A, they're the open questions that science is not actually terribly good at solving. So he says, the sciences in their modern form are all practical and applied to specific goals. As such, they're stripped of their existential functions as knowledge that locates us within the world. So if you go back to early proto-science and ancient cultures, if you go back and look at the cosmological ideas in the pre-Socratics or in the Upanishads, they're fulfilling a double role. They're trying to give you practical knowledge about how the world functions, but they're also orienting you with regard to the world. Right? And again, back to Haddo speaks about this. He says, but modern science ceases to do that. It's no longer trying to orient you. It's much more presenting itself as an applied form of knowledge that has practical goals. So this is something that he's agreeing with Heidegger on. Science has become a purely utilitarian practice, and now that it's become the dominant mode of thinking about the world, it's turned us into primarily utilitarian creatures. The problem is, the problem with that is if it's the case that we as existential creatures have a basic inclination towards these bigger questions, attempting to interpret ourselves as purely utilitarian, purely pragmatic, purely animals gaining certain limited, specific, immediate goals, means that we will continue to misinterpret ourselves and fail to fulfill basic human needs. He says it's wrong to treat science with quite the enthusiasm it had been given at the time he's writing in the 20th century, and he's writing around the 80s. He says it's wrong to treat science with this new note of expectation for its benefits. He said, should the questions to which science does not know the answer be shunted aside, even though they still concern the human mind and have called forth the grand answers of the religions, the mythologies, artistic creations like tragedies and intellectual works like the Platonic dialogues. Right, so science can't answer those things. Such sciences cannot pose the questions, here, quote, pose the questions that unceasingly stir our desire to know, questions that truly spring from wonder. Is there merely time at all, or is time merely in us? So what we just were talking about with Ricoeur yesterday. Why is there anything at all and not nothing? In some ways, that's not a scientific question. It's always irreducibly, at some level, a philosophical or a religious question. Quote, and what is consciousness and self-consciousness in which everything exists once again? How should we understand that this self-illuminating luminosity that we call consciousness will eventually come to an end? How should anyone who thinks this understand it?
What is this from?
This is from 157, a book called Reason in the Age of Science. So it was an extensive list of essays in which he criticizes scientific rationality, kind of following on Heidegger, but in some ways going, doing slightly different things. So science mustn't be confused with philosophy as a discourse that tries to give a thinking justification of ourselves, a giving account of ourselves in the sense of the Greek phrase, thank you, logon didone. And he sees philosophy, briefly, he sees philosophy as offering that kind of existential formulation. And he also sees poetry as doing this, sort of talk given to the Stephen George Society. He argued that poetry tries to recapture what is mythical, the whole, the church, and the knowledge of a whole people, in cultural forms that are able to renew the whole by finding, quote, communicatively effective words which would satisfy everyone's endowment for justification. The poet here is like a philosopher, he argued. And he warned his audience of poetry lovers not to be too frightened by the word philosophy, he says. Right? He even makes a connection to the Upanishads in his speech to them. He says, art, whether picture, word, sound, song, or whatever its origin, was or present function may be, art means in the final analysis a way of confronting ourselves, the world as a whole. The whole of our world experience has become present in poetry. And even the most silent forms of modern painting, which radiate a brooding silence, evoke in us the you are that. And he's referring, he's got a little, tiny little hint of a Tatwa Masi that he's gotten hold of there somewhere. So this notion of the whole, in short, A, he believes that what's distinctive about religious discourse and worldview is what it shares with philosophy and poetry. It seeks to answer existential concerns and not merely to deal with immediate applied concerns, and that means answering the human need to understand itself in relation to the whole, including those complicated questions that he referred to. That means the whole, quote-unquote, is a hugely important concept for him. And that's, again, what's distinctive about philosophy, poetry, and religion is something that kind of combines them. It always tries to frame the whole of things. Okay, and he talks at length about this. He goes on in various texts about how Hegel does this, how the ancient Greeks did this, how all the different kinds of historical contexts in which we see different writers and cultures trying to find a way of speaking about the nature of the whole. Okay. And science doesn't seems to do that, but in fact it doesn't do that. One of the ways in which science most fails to do that, unfortunately...
Is he talking about the... Have we shifted to religious worldview, or are we still in existential?
That's a good question. So here he's effectively saying that he's speaking about philosophy and he's speaking about poetry. And rather than speaking about religion, he speaks about those two discourses and says what they are doing is religious. So he says, he literally, you know, says here and there, this is religious, or this is mythical, or this is the ancient world views that sought to orient humans. So he's treating the religious as a category, a kind of a function that these different discourses fulfill. So the third point is these existential concerns must be addressed. They must do that partly through a genuine worldview that deals with the whole. One of the most important things about a worldview that genuinely is willing to deal with the whole, and this is one of the ways you can tell it from science, is that it's willing to admit that there is an infinity to the whole that we can never encompass in any worldview. So it is willing to allow mystery, infinity, the unknowable, and the kind of that which exceeds the excess and an epistemological excess into its worldview. And this is part of why he actually champions the artist and the philosopher as kind of spiritual heroes. Philosophy is constantly engaged in the willingness to identify the limits of its knowledge. So epistemology, which seems very boring and kind of limiting, is actually always the point where we go, we can only know so far. But what we don't get to do is then say nothing else exists. We say we don't know, right? So it wants to see the whole. It fills the horizon, but it also gets to the edge of that horizon and admits it and stands on that edge and lets the unknown be there as it is. And he says you can see this in many different specific philosophical systems. So, for instance, he says he's a supporter of good infinity in Hegel. Hegel tries to produce a picture of the whole of the world in his notion of Geist, of spirit. And one of the critiques of Hegel is often that he has this notion of absolute spirit, which seems to imply a final, complete fulfillment of everything in God. And that appears to make Hegel useless for some. One argument is that it makes Hegel useless for those who are not religious and do not agree that God is a valid concept in which to try and give a culmination of fulfillment to the notion of spirit. But Gadamer says, actually, Hegel also mentions the notion of infinity, and bad infinity is where it seems to make everything meaningless. Good infinity is where we admit that spirit goes on and on and on. There are many forms and concepts and historical emergences and potential manifestations of spirit that we will never know, we can't even imagine, that exceed our understanding. He says, but that is actually a good thing. And he says, it's actually possible to incorporate an awareness of that infinity in ourselves. Indeed, poetry is one of the ways in which we do that. So the idea that in a poem, a particular phrase or word resonates meanings, but there's no... It's unlike a symbol or a sign, there's no clearly defined set of meanings it points to. The dark tree points to an endless range of meanings that can proliferate endlessly, that doesn't really have an ending. All such semantically evocative and resonant words do precisely that. And that's why we love poetry. That's why poetic words sit well in the human psyche, not because they're well-defined, complete, and finished, but precisely because they open us out to a kind of an inner awareness of the further infinite reaches of meaning and of the world around us. So he actually argues that it's not that we want completion in our worldview that summarizes the whole, rather we want it to be open in some significant and important way. So that openness to infinity is something that he writes about at length and supports very strongly, and says that poetry's value is that it is able to figure that to us, to incorporate it into our way of thinking, and poetry's value is similarly so, although in a different kind of discourse. And the last thing, simply, is that he feels that the actual activity of spirituality is the process by which we form ourselves in relation to this kind of grand vision. Right? So I said in the last class that he has a notion of self that is constantly emerging, constantly changing, that we can, if we like, take control of and shape in relation to the world. So what we are is not a fixed thing. What we are is a constantly shifting, changing, environmentally connected thing. Spirituality is for us to create, self-creativity is to see what we are and then actively, with will and creative determination, shape ourselves through time. Spiritual self-creativity. Self-creativity.
Spiritual.
That's a very good question, actually. He does in places, and I could give quotes where one of the problems, virtues and problems with Gadamer is he doesn't tend to terminologize things. So Ricoeur and others will come up with little terms that they then use repeatedly, and that those are the things that make their texts hard to read if you don't know their terminology, and easier to read if you do. Gadamer almost never does that. Even the fusion of horizons, the terms for which he's famous, turn up very, very rarely. But what he has instead is a slightly older style of writing, where he'll go through kind of descriptions of what he does use the word spiritual, what the spiritual is, or what the fundamental human satisfaction is found through, etc. So it actually be quite interesting to look through the language that he uses for that. But for him, spiritual activity, and this kind of fits with his mother's German Pietist history, and as we'll see next week, it fits very well with his notion of pantheist sort of thinkers. Spiritual activity is to shape ourselves in a genuine engagement with existential questions, in relation to the whole, and in relation to a whole which is open, mysterious, infinite, and ultimately unknowable, right? Which is hard, but in a sense, that's precisely the element that spiritualizes this activity of knowing and being that humans undergo. So it's a specific interpretation of what the religious is, but it's very much an interpretation of the religious that pays a great deal of attention to fundamental forms of discourse that have a distinctive way of understanding human life. Right? So for him, worldview is actually incredibly important. Okay.